Good to be with you again tonight. Appreciate the songs we've sung and prayers been prayed. And I'm looking forward to our study tonight. Moses number 11 is what we're at, if you're keeping track. Number 11, believe it or not. And hopefully you've come along this journey and you've seen the beginning of Moses and seen how he became this timid servant that was really unwilling to go at first and debated and argued with God about going, and finally he did go. And now that we have seen him talk with Pharaoh through Aaron and be a part of this great work, we've seen Pharaoh on the ropes, but Moses and Aaron seem to be quite calm and collected. Gone is the timidity and some of the fear that originally was there. And so even with Moses, we have seen a maturation process take place. And it reminds me of our life's duties that before us that cause us consternation and we're not looking forward to it. However, when the hour comes and our service is required and we push through and we do it under the strength of God, and He gives us the grace in such a time and ability and strength, and we actually find out the fearing of doing it was worse than actually being a part of the process. Because none of the narrative do you read how Moses is saying, "Lord, now I'm afraid, I want to turn back, I want to stop." None of that. There just seems to be some calm and some collectedness in what he and Aaron are doing together, and that will continue. However, it will become a downward spiral for Pharaoh as things get worse and worse. If you think about it, no one ever really likes the feeling of being proved wrong. I've never enjoyed that feeling. I've been wrong before. And when you come to that point, you have then an option. You can choose to press on your pride and try and double down and show how you're not wrong and just humiliate yourself worse. Or you can finally admit it and change. The prideful hate change. You'll see people that will cling to their false religions even though they are proved conclusively without a shred of doubt that they are wrong religions. And they'll go down in flames with it. And you're seeing that take place with Pharaoh himself. Pharaoh was prideful, and most dictators really, really are. In fact, I heard read a story of the dictator of North Korea in 2010, Kim Jong-il, who was so elated that his team had made the World Cup that they lifted the live broadcasting ban upon public television there in North Korea so they might televise the games. And after that was done, North Korea promptly lost the next two games and were eliminated. They lost it with a combined score of 10-0. They were just blown out and humiliated. And when that poor soccer coach got back to North Korea, he was exiled and put into forced labor at a government construction site. No one likes to lose 10-0, especially dictators. And here you're going to see Pharaoh, who was a dictator in himself, going to lose 10-0. Now, if you're keeping score, we've made it through six plagues, and it is still now 6-0 in favor of God. In fact, God has been stacking up victims of Egyptian gods. He has taken down Hapi, the Nile god. He is gone. Nethor and Hathor and 30 other gods that are connected to the Nile. Sometimes it's a direct affront to the god of the particular item itself or to those that are connected loosely to it that are somehow dependent upon the Nile. And those things take place with a lot of these various plagues. Hiket and Canum, and you watch it, the fly god, and Gib, the god of the ground, and Ptah, and Hathor, the cattle god, and Menephis, the bull god, and Sekhet, diseases, and Sarfis, healing, and Imhotep, medicine. All of these gods have been tackled through the various plagues so far, whether it be through boils or whether it be through the ground giving up these insects that would then plague the Egyptians. And in time, it will be Yahweh more than 10 to 0, just racking up these gods of Egypt. More are going to come tonight. Seth, Men, Ra, Ripishu, Gitash, Isis. All of these gods are going to fall. Now remember, this is a very religious society. It is not a secular society at all. Everything was religious. And God is here to say, here is the true way and the true God. And you shall know, the Egyptians shall know, and Pharaoh shall know that I am the Lord. So without further ado, let's turn our Bibles to Exodus chapter 9. And we'll enter into the third set of three with plague number 7, and that of hail mingled with fire. Now we are getting to the most intense set. And we'll again see that familiar pattern. God speaking to Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron speaking to Pharaoh. Pharaoh rejecting what was spoken to him, thus bringing the plague and thus hardening Pharaoh's heart. And hit repeat once again. So verse 13, the Lord said to Moses, "Rise early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh and say to him, 'Thus says the Lord God of the Hebrews, let my people go, that they may serve me. For at this time I will send all my plagues to your very heart, and on your servants and on your people, that you may know that there is none like me in all the earth.'" You might underline that. This is God's purpose. He's wanting people to know who He is. Verse 15, "Now if I had stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, then you would have been cut off from the earth. But indeed, for this purpose, I've raised you up, that I may show my power in you, and that my name may be declared in all the earth. As yet you exalt yourself against my people, and that you will not let them go. Behold, tomorrow, about this time, I will cause very heavy hail to rain down, such as not been in Egypt since its founding until now. Therefore, send now and gather your livestock, all that you have in the field, for the hail shall come down on every man, every animal which is found in the field, and that is not brought in the home, and they shall die. He who feared the word of the Lord among the servants of Pharaoh made his servants and his livestock flee to the houses. But he who did not regard the word of the Lord left his servants and his livestock in the field. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand towards heaven, that there may be hail in all the land of Egypt, on man, on beast, on every herb of the field throughout the land of Egypt. And Moses stretched out, notice, his rod towards heaven. And the Lord sent thunder and hail and fire darted to the ground, and the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt. So there was hail and fire mingled with the hail, so very heavy that there was none like it in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. And the hail struck throughout the whole land of Egypt, all that was in the field, both man and beast. And the hail struck every herb of the field and broke every tree of the field. Only in the land of Goshen, where the children of Israel were, there was no hail. What an amazing display of, we might say, fireworks. I mean, this is coming from the sky, this tremendous sized hail. Hail that had never been seen since the founding of Egypt. And sometimes it looked like they were comets or fireballs coming from heaven as well, as the hail was mingled with flame, it says. And you can see it descending from the sky and hitting land and houses and people. I mean, could you imagine that sight? You see animals scurrying down the road on fire from what has just lit them, or even human beings. And it says that it struck both man and beast. So lives were lost in this great plague. They say in 1995 in Thomasville, Georgia, there's what they called a supercell hailstorm that took place, very localized. And there was hail the size of softballs. And it totally destroyed that community. I mean, just imagine what these hails might have looked like. Football size. Who's to know exactly? But it would have devastated all that was there, and setting homes aflame as well. Well, verse 27, Pharaoh sent and called for Moses and Aaron and said to them, "I have sinned this time. The Lord is righteous, and my people and I are wicked. Entreat, pray to the Lord that there may be no more mighty thunderings and hail, for it is enough. I will let you go, and you shall stay no longer." Now this is plague 7. Pharaoh says, "I've sinned. My people are wicked. We are wicked. Pray to the Lord, and I will let you go. You can all go." Well, verse 30, Moses would entreat the Lord. He says, but in verse 30, "But as for you and your servants, I know that you will not yet fear the Lord God." He says, I know what's going to take place here. It's not over yet. I can see it. I can tell it. I can know. I can see it in your eyes. You say you'll let us go, but this is not over yet. It's not over. I have that feeling. I don't know about you, but I don't have to be a prophet, but there are some times where you can know when someone's not telling you the truth. You can see it in their eyes well, or in their voice, or you just know they're not broken down. They're not really sorry. I mean, they're sorry they got caught, maybe, but there's really no genuine remorse, no change that wells up within their convictions. And there's an old saying, those convinced against their will are of the same opinion still. And here we see Pharaoh, no doubt, convinced against his own will. The spirit of Pharaoh still lives in many today. Like I said, I see it in preaching more times than I care to see it. Oh, I need to change. I will change. And yet the next time you see them, they do the same things over and over again. Like Pharaoh, very easily breaking promises, thinking very little about it. I remember one individual, they're not here anymore, but they were getting weaker and weaker, and I could see it, and I said, "You know, where were you this Sunday? I really wish you would have been here at services and we could worship God together. I'm sorry, I know I should have been there, but I'll be there tonight. I'll be there Sunday night." So I told the person, "I appreciate you giving me your word that you'll be there." They said, "Oh, no, I didn't give you my word." "Well, you said you'd be there." "Yes, I'll be there, but I didn't give you my word." And what I come to find out is that they didn't use that phrase, "I give you my word." So therefore, the statement that "I'll be there tonight" was non-binding. And so I told the individual, you know, whether it's "I give you my word," or "I promise," or "I swear," or "by the very gold of the temple," or whatever it is. The Lord said, "Let your yes be yes and your no be no." And sure enough, they weren't there that Sunday night anyway. The spirit of Pharaoh still lives today. "I will let your people go." Moses said, "I can see it. You do not yet fear the Lord. You will not let us go." And so that brings plague number 8, and that of locusts. Little by little, God has been taking away all of their food supply, and starvation will be inevitable. We saw fields destroyed, the land corrupted by the swarms, and then we see the cattle diseased and killed off, and the, what remained was destroyed by the hail, and now we've got the locusts, and they're just going to come in and just plow through everything and just polish the land off. So in chapter 10, There, verse 12, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locusts, that they may come upon the land of Egypt and eat every herb of the land, all that the hail has left. So Moses stretched out his rod over the land of Egypt, and the Lord brought an east wind on the land all that day and all that night. When it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. And the locusts went up over all the land of Egypt and rested on all the territory of Egypt. And they were very severe. Previously there had been no such locusts as they, nor shall there be such after them. For they covered the face of the whole earth, so that the land was darkened, and they ate every herb of the land, all the food, the fruit of the trees which the hail had left, so that there remained nothing green of the trees or on the plants of the field throughout all the land of Egypt. They just wiped it out. They've done documentaries of various locusts and swarms, and they had have a commentator, a narrator, and he would go out there and stand in the midst of it, and through the sound of the approaching swarm, it sounded like a 747 is approaching. It's so deafening. And then when it finally hits the narrator, you can't hardly even see him anymore. You can't even hear him over the sound. It's deafening. It just covers everything around. The Bible even said the land was totally dark, and in the aerial shots would show it looks like the ground is just black. Completely engulfed in these locusts. And so you can get a kind of a mind's eye of what's taking place here in Egypt. Now in chapter 10 there in verse 7, Pharaoh's servant said to him, how long shall this man be a snare to us? Let the men go, that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed? That was before the locusts actually come. We are done. We are decimated as a power. Our economy is shot. All of our food supply is devastated. And yet, Pharaoh doubled down, hardened his heart, and here came the swarm and took it more away. And yet, if they were to glance over there in Goshen, where the force field of God was, there they'd see cattle on the ground grazing, trees blossoming, trees bearing fruit, fields of grain, healthy children with no boils on their skin playing there in the streets. You get the picture. You get the picture. And the Egyptians were getting it as well. This was the I Am. And the I Am was the only one that has ever been. None of our gods have helped us one bit. And so the third set of three ends with the ninth plague. And just like the other ones, comes without warning or announcement. Before I studied this, I never had noticed that before. But now you see that that's the case. And God kind of showing His stair-step progression by graciously giving them more time to change, and yet they just stubbornly rebel. So He says in verse 21, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand towards heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, darkness which may even be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand towards heaven, and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. Now this is some kind of miraculous darkness, where he describes it, a darkness that could even be felt. It, perhaps some mixture with the sand or some kind of elements, but I don't know. But it was so dark. It's one of those things where you put your hand in front of your face and you can't see it. But unlike the caves where they asked us to do that to demonstrate how dark it is in a cave, and then they flip on a switch or turn on a flashlight, they were not able to do that here. You almost get the picture. If they were somehow able to light a lamp, there would be no light emitting from it. They couldn't see. How dark this must have been. And God here is striking against Osiris and Isis, who controlled the stars, and Ra, the sun god. He is so powerful and they are so powerless. No power at all. Utter darkness. It must have felt like death. I mean, could you imagine being buried alive? I mean, I know that's lists pretty high in some of people's worst fears, to be buried alive in a casket 6 feet underground. Imagine how dark that would be. And in that darkness, you lose sense of balance, which is up and which is actually down. These people, it says, would not even rise up. That's, you almost get the idea. They felt like they were dead, like they were buried. Which way is up? Which way is down? They would not even rise up. So all of Egypt essentially becomes like a ghost town. The hustling and bustling of everyday life, nothing. No one goes anywhere. If this happened in America, the stock market would crash. If everything came to a halt, goodbye economy. And can you imagine the Israelites there in Goshen looking over there saying, wow, it is dark. And it's silent. Nobody is doing anything. Nothing at all. Kind of reminds me of the silence before the storm. Because the 10th plague would be the worst of all. And also the passage that says, let all the earth keep silence before Him. The sobering humbleness that comes in those quiet hours where one will reflect upon who it is that has caused such to take place in their lives. And so we see now plague number 10, the death of the firstborn. Remember what Moses was to say in chapter 4, we read it this morning, 22 and 23, that God said, Israel's my firstborn, and you had better let my firstborn go, or I will kill your firstborn. And so now it is about to take place. Chapter 11, 1. The Lord said to Moses, I'll bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out of here altogether. Speak now in the hearing of the people, and let every man ask from his neighbor, and every woman from her neighbor, articles of silver and articles of gold. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh and the servants, and in the servants of Pharaoh, and in the sight of the people. And Moses said, thus says the Lord, about midnight, I will go out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sits on the throne, even to the firstborn of the female servant who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the animals. Then there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as was not like it before, nor shall be like it again. How frightful that would be! And we have to remember that these plagues didn't happen so that you and I can read a couple millennia later and say, ooh, in awe about it. But to be in awe all the same, and to understand that there are some major truths that we can learn from God's devastation on the Egyptian Empire. Two come to the forefront of my mind, and that is, number one, when God judges, He does a thorough job of it. He finishes the job. And number two, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. As the Hebrew writer says. Now maybe there's some here that have been in the danger zone for too long, fooling themselves that they can play fast and loose, ignore warning after warning, reject appeal after appeal, But understand, when there is a day of reckoning that arrives, and it will eventually arrive, that His judgments are terribly thorough. Now in this life, as long as you live, let me tell you, there is hope. There is still hope. And His judgments can be restorative. They can restore, or they can harden, as they did with Pharaoh. And the difference maker is you, your heart. You get to choose what it does to you. But you think about progressions in what we might call chastisements or judgments. If you have someone that thinks it's okay to drink, then what they've done is enabling themselves an allowance to let their inhibitions down. And so they do that. Well, when their inhibitions are down, it's easier then to go to the next sin, perhaps like premarital sex. And when that takes place, what could happen is maybe an unwanted pregnancy. If they continue along those lines, it could eventually lead to a sexually transmitted disease. And to continue to fight against the chastisements and the judgments might eventually lead to very painful death. And that's just one illustration. Another one might give themselves to drug use. And because of that, they lose their job. When they lose their job, they lose their reputation. Once everyone finds out why they lost their job. Once they lose their reputation, they lose their home. And then they lose their family. One plague leads to another and to another. God's judgments are thorough. And it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Now Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 1 and 2 there. As Habakkuk was thinking about the judgments of God that would come upon the nation of Israel in a later time, pleading with God, there he reminds God to remember mercy in the midst of judgment. Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 1, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet of Sigonoth. O Lord, I have heard your speech and I was afraid. O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known in wrath. Remember mercy. And so in those times, let us not despise the chastening of the Lord, because He is a merciful God, and sometimes He utilizes the wrath to bring about a merciful action upon those that will be softened and not hardened by His judgments. Well, now comes the most intense punishment of them all. And Moses had conveyed to Pharaoh five things that are going to take place. Number one, Pharaoh, this is going to happen around midnight. Number two, Pharaoh, all of Egypt's firstborn will die. Number three, Pharaoh, every house will cry. Number four, Israel's going to be protected. And number five, there will be an exodus. There will be an exodus. You might call this the night that nobody slept. In Exodus chapter 12, the Lord in the meantime was preparing the Israelites to be ready to go. God says, this is going to happen fast, it's going to happen quick. You guys got to be ready. And when I give the signal, you got to go. In Exodus 12, there, verse 29, it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was on in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. Can you imagine? There was not a house where there was not one dead. Can you imagine the amount of funerals that are about to take place? The graves that would have to be dug. Not a house without one that would die. Can you imagine how those first few minutes past midnight begin to roll? The first few cries that gradually crescendo into a cascading waterfall of moans and groans, shrieks, wailing. I mean, that eerie doesn't describe how that would have sounded. What a deadly night. A night that nobody slept. Well, what of Israel? How were they spared? Not a little thing, but a huge thing called a Passover would be a part of their sparing. Now, up to this point, God has said, look, watch what I'm going to do to Egypt, and you're going to know I'm the Lord. Now God is starting to ask Israel to play a role, to be involved. All right? There's something you need to do, Israel. In Exodus chapter 12, verse 22, it says, you shall take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood, this is the blood of the lamb, and strike the lintels and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of this house until morning. For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel, on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to come into your homes to strike you. Now, again, this is no thought to wink at. Israel had never done something like this before. And God essentially is doing to them what I asked this morning. Are you listening to the preaching from the plagues? Are you learning, Israel? Here's what happens to people that do not obey my voice. Will you now obey me? I've asked you to do something. He's testing them now. If he wanted to, he could have done as he did the other plagues. Let this invisible force field go up and everyone in the land of Goshen safe. But he didn't choose that. He chose for the Israelites to now play a role that their faith and obedience might be tested. Now, we have sort of a disadvantage. We live in these New Testament times, if you can call it a disadvantage, in the sense that we know the story. We know how it goes. We know what the Passover is pointing to. Christ is our Passover, Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. But their livingness at this moment, what is all going on here? What is he telling them to do? I mean, this is contrary to logic. I mean, blood on doorposts and lintels? How logical is that? It's not at all. Not at all. And that's the point. It was a plan that required one to completely trust that God knew what he was doing. That would require obedience. Now, he didn't say, now, here's what you need to understand. Let me help you think through this. No, he didn't. God said it, and that settled it. And that's what he wanted to see. Did it really settle it for them? Did it? That would be the only reason that they needed, that God said it, and that's what we're going to do. Okay. So in Exodus 12, flip back to verse 7, he says, and they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintels of the houses where they eat it. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night. Now notice these details. Roasted in fire, with unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs, they shall eat it. Verse 9. Do not eat it raw, nor boiled at all with water, but roasted in fire. Its head with its legs and its entrails. You shall let none of it remain until morning. And what remains of it until morning you shall burn with fire. And thus you shall eat it, with a belt on your waist, and your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. So you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. So there's all these details, loads of details that God has said, here's exactly the way to eat this meal. Just obey it. Don't question it. Just do what I've asked to do. Be dressed. And obviously their dress is ready for travel. Ready to be deployed. Tonight's the night. I'm going to give the signal. 400 years of slavery is going to come to an end. It ends tonight. Now Pharaoh, he wouldn't obey me. Israel, will you obey me? I mean, would we? I mean, would you? Without knowing the story? Seems kind of strange, doesn't it? I mean, they never read the Exodus. There was no wilderness handbook. There's no guarantees at all, except that you know you go with God. That's all. That's it. We're leaving familiar for the unfamiliar. Here we go. Would that be enough for you to know that I go with God? Families would leave their cherished home that night for the unknown because they would obey. You see, there would be a difference between them and Egypt. They would obey. And I want to say it didn't really matter how they felt about it. And I want you to think long and hard about that statement. See, obedience is not, it's never really ever been a feeling kind of thing. There's lots of times where I didn't feel like doing something that maybe God's asked me to do. There's been times I didn't feel like preaching, you know, or feel like coming to services. You know, I just didn't quite feel like it. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter. My major need is to simply obey God's word. It's that simple. Why do we make it so complex? Oh yeah, we know what the Passover would point to in the future. The Messiah. But here they had no clue of what that meant. Just obey it. Just do what God has asked. And that is a great lesson for us. A great lesson for us. Because there may be commands today that are required upon us. Why is baptism necessary to be saved? Well, I may have an idea, but I may not know the exact reason why, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. God said it, and that settles it. What about the worship of the church? Why is it this way? And why can't we have these things that are not necessarily in the Word of God in the New Testament? Why can't? Because God said it. And that settles it. Why do elders have to meet these certain qualifications in 1 Timothy chapter 3? I mean, I know a lot of nice men that seem like good men, but they're missing a qualification or two. Why not? You're trying to think your way through it. You're trying to feel it. And it's not, obedience is not a feeling kind of thing. It's a testing kind of thing. Will you trust me, God says, with what I've asked you to do? And will you display that trust by doing nothing more and nothing less of what I've asked you to do? Follow the details. Will you do that? Will you do that? Just obey. Didn't matter how you feel about it. Just obey. Didn't matter if you get all the whys about it. Just obey. Walk with God, and He will lead you. And He was going to lead them through the wilderness into the promised land. That was His plan. And in Exodus chapter 12, there verse 24, He tells them, "You shall observe this thing, this Passover, as an ordinance for you and your sons forever. It will come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, just as He promised, that you shall keep the service. And it shall be when your children say to you, 'What do you mean by this service?' that you shall say, 'It is the Passover sacrifice of the Lord, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, when He struck the Egyptians and delivered our households.' So the people bowed their heads and worshipped." Now notice verse 28. "And the children of Israel went away and did so, just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did." Some of the sweetest words you'll read in all the Bible. Just as it was commanded, and so they did. And they bowed and worshipped the Lord. Oh, if only they would have kept that spirit all the way through to the keeping of the promised land. We know they didn't. But here at that moment, they didn't know they wouldn't. Here at that moment, God had given this command, "We will be faithful with it." And they were. They were. And God says, there's going to come a time in that land where your children ask, what is this thing that we're doing? And you'll tell them all about the story of how I saved you. Now, we have the advantage of living in New Testament times to see how Christ is our Passover. And He has blessed us with a memorial that He said, do this in remembrance of me. And when our children ask the same question, why do you take that little bread and drink that little cup? Why is it we meet here on the Lord's Day and do these kinds of things? That we're also to be ready to give an answer. Because the Lord has saved us from our sin. Seeking to deliver us from the wilderness of life and lead us to the promised land. This now is our memorial, Christ Jesus and what He's done for me, that our children might learn what God can do for them. And God was stair-step preparing the Israelites for one day to receive the Son of God. We have that advantage now that we can know Him. And maybe there's someone here tonight that hasn't come to also know Him. They may understand Him, but haven't come to be in fellowship with Him. To experience the salvation of their sins. The Lord told us in Matthew 7 that one day He'll declare to people that said that they knew Him, I never knew you. There wasn't a fellowship established. We want Him to acknowledge us, to say that He knows us as we know Him. How do we do that? When we obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. Very simple. He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. Are you sure? Yeah, I'm sure, because He said it, and that's why. And then if you remain faithful to death, He'll give us the crown of life. Are you sure about that? Absolutely, I can take it to the bank. Why? Because He said it. And so, dear friend, if you're here tonight, haven't obeyed the gospel, you can do so. Become a child of God. Be saved by Him. If you are a child of God, but you've left the family of God, won't you come back, be restored, and He'll forgive you again. Won't you come when we stand and sing? Jesus, stand.